Thank you very much, everyone in the audience. Thank you for coming here, and a very warm welcome to His Excellency Ümit Yalçın, Ambassador of Turkey, who is here with us today in the audience. And of course, a very warm welcome to our distinguished speakers, our audience in the room, and our audience on Zoom and Facebook. My name is Yaprak Gürsoy, and I'm professor and chair of contemporary Turkish studies at the European Institute at LSE. I'm very pleased to be a part of this hybrid event hosted by contemporary Turkish studies, the European Institute, and the British Institute at Ankara. Before I start introducing the event and our speakers, let me remind you of technical details. Please bear with me as I go through my important list. First, let me remind everyone to put your phones on silent so that there's not going to be a disruption of the event. The event is being recorded and it will be available as a podcast later on our website. For those Twitter users, the hashtag for today's event is LSCTurkey. Once our speakers give their initial talks, there will be the chance for you to ask your questions to our panelists. For our online audience, you can submit your questions at any time via the Q&A feature on Zoom. That's going to be at the bottom of your screens. But please remember to include your names and affiliations. And for those of you who are in the room with us today, I will let you know when we will open the floor for questions. Please raise your hand when you know the time comes, and there's going to be a roving microphone. Please wait for the microphone to come, and please also again state who you are and your affiliation. Now, I will try to ensure a range of questions from both our online audience and our audience here in the theater, but that's again once our speakers have finished their initial talks. At the end of our seminar, there's going to be a reception, and if we cannot, you know, take all of the questions, we can continue the chat and discussion in the reception. Now, moving on to the introduction of the event. Recently, there have been increasing academic and media interest of the restitution of archaeological artifacts, and I'm sure during the summer you have seen these news reports as well. While the Benin bronzes continue to attract attention, the matter of the return of Elgin or Parthenon marbles are also being widely discussed. As the European Institute, we also wanted to address this matter, address the matter of archaeology and the recent debates surrounding it. Our first event on the matter was carried out by the Hellenic Observatory yesterday. And if you missed it, you can actually listen to the podcast on their website when it becomes available. Complementing these discussions, as the Contemporary Turkish Studies Unit at LSE and the British Institute at Ankara, we wanted to approach the matter from a different angle and in relation to international relations, recognizing the potential positive influence of archaeological exchanges and soft power and international relations, including bilateral relations between Turkey and the UK. Therefore, I'm very pleased to be welcoming our prominent speakers who would be able to discuss archaeology and soft power within their respective fields and areas of expertise. Our first speaker, Professor Stephen Mitchell, is an emeritus professor of classics and ancient history. He was the Leverholm Research, he was the Leverholm Professor of Hellenic Culture from 2002 and 2011. And is a fellow of the British Academy. He has served 3 terms as honorary secretary of the British Institute at Ankara and served as the chair from 2016 to 2021. During this period, he was co-organizer of the British Institute at Ankara's From Enemies to Allies project, which explored the Turkish-British relationship at a political and diplomatic level from 1914 to 1960. Most of his world-leading and published work has been concerned with Asia Minor in antiquity, explored through texts, inscriptions, and archaeology with a particular emphasis on religious and cultural history. Our second speaker will be Sir David Bolton, who was British ambassador to Turkey from 1997 to 2001. He also served in Turkey from 1965 to 1970. For most of his career, he specialized in East-West relations and in defense policy. He served as deputy chief of mission at the embassies in Moscow and Washington. In London, his appointments included assistant undersecretary of state for Central and Eastern European Affairs and subsequently for defense policy. Since retirement from the FCO, he has been director of the Center for Studies in Security and Diplomacy at Birmingham University, a senior fellow of the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, and chair of the British Institute at Ankara. He is a fellow of the Society of Antiquities, or Antiquities, right?
Antiquaries,
okay. Close enough. Holds an honorary doctorate at Birmingham University. Our final speaker will be Professor Tuna Şare Atürk, who is a Mercury Research Fellow at the Faculty of Classics, University of Oxford. And she is also a professor of classical art and archaeology at Çanakkale 18 Mart University in Turkey. Her main research interests are ancient Greek and Roman art and the archaeology of Asia Minor. Her research in the ancient Roman city of Nicomedia has brought to light one of the most significant archaeological discoveries of recent years in Asia Minor, a new monument of Roman power. She has published on ancient threats and identity, cross-cultural interactions and material hybridity in Asia Minor, ancient painting, monuments of the Roman imperial cult, and classical reception in Turkey. So without further ado, Professor Mitchell, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Professor Kosoy, for this kind introduction. And I'd like to start by saying how delighted I am to be here. The first time, I think, in my life that I've stepped into a room in the LSE, which shows how we are sort of confined to our sort of subject areas, but the School of Economics and Political Science is a very appropriate place to be. And it's a particular pleasure that the Turkish ambassador is here today, a particular pleasure for me because I had the chance, I think, to meet him about 4 years ago when I was chair of the British Institute at Ankara. And so it's an honor and a pleasure to make the acquaintance again on this occasion. I'm speaking in a way on behalf of one of the three hosts of this event, the British Institute at Ankara. And in a sense, what I have to say will be about the British Institute at Ankara and its role in relation to our topic today. And I'm going to divide what I've got to say into roughly into three parts. First, some words explaining what the British Institute at Ankara is, or more precisely, what the British International Research Institutes are, because there's a group of eight of them. Then I'm going to have a little bit to say about the British Institute at Ankara's history from its foundation 75 years ago till the early 2000s, and then end up by focusing on some of the current work in Turkey, which defines its current role. The British Institute at Ankara, now 75 years old almost, is one of eight international research institutes supported and partially funded by the British Academy, therefore indirectly by UK Treasury, whose work focuses on the Middle East, the Mediterranean, East and North Africa. Most of its branches, its schools and institutes, were founded as bases for archaeological work, although all of them now have wider subject portfolios. The two British schools at Athens and Rome, respectively, are venerable institutions that date back to the end of the 19th or the beginning of the 20th century. The others are all post-Second World War creations. The two research institutes whose titles locate them respectively in Iran and Iraq are currently barely active in their respective countries for reasons that are fairly obvious, although they're sustained by the enthusiasm and commitment of their UK-based membership. The Iraq School, for instance, runs programs which support in-country initiatives protecting Iraq's cultural heritage. The Iran School currently is looking beyond the boundaries of Iran to the wider Iranian diaspora, as one might say, towards Central Asia, as they redefine a role for themselves in current world climate. The Society for Libyan Studies, one of the other group, doesn't have a base in country, but has lately redefined itself as a British Institute for Libyan and North African Studies. And the British Institute in East Africa, with a base in Nairobi, is in fact concerned with research across several East African countries, not only Kenya. These organizations are not government institutions. They're all unlike their nearest counterparts in Europe, which are the German Archaeological Institutes, which are a sort of branch of the German Foreign Office. They're all private organizations, charitable organizations run by boards of trustees, which receive some government funding. Their main raison d'etre is to conduct academic research, which leads to a better understanding of the regions where they're located. The common factor for all theories, which in my view distinguishes their work from that of British universities, is that they have an enormous reservoir, in every case, of local knowledge and expertise, usually acquired over decades of in-country work in their respective locations. This is obviously a source of academic as well as institutional strength. Close collaborations with partners in, should we call it, the host country, whether it's Turkey, Kenya, Greece, or anywhere else, enables them to work on issues that would be inaccessible to researchers working from outside the country. And prolonged in-country experience gives them, I think, a resilience, although not, of course, immunity to local political turbulence, as well as generating complex and productive bonds and partnerships in a regional environment. It's important, however, that said, from Grandio's introduction, to remind everybody that these research institutes are actually very small institutions. They're not funded with, and the total funding for the BIRIS through the British Academy is under £5 million a year for all of them. So we're not talking large institutions with large staff, but they do aspire at least to punch above their weight in terms of attracting other funding and conducting research on a broader range than one might predict for a small organization. Moving on to the sort of second part of my sort of presentation, from the BIRIS to the BIA and a little bit about its history. Archaeology, or subjects related to archaeology, including, and I think this is very important, the management of cultural heritage in various countries, are crucial to the, have been and still are crucial to the work of all these institutes. In the Turkish context, the BIAA's work is distinctively different, I think, from most of the research conducted by Turkey's own archaeologists, who, strongly guided by the policies and aspirations of the Turkish Ministry of Culture, focus almost all their research on excavations. That, in a sense, defines, shall we say, 80 to 90% of the actual field of archaeology as understood in country. Since about 2010, Turkish government policy has been to restrict the number of foreign excavations in Turkey and to transfer responsibility for many sites previously carried out by foreign teams to Turkish archaeologists. And I think Tuna is going to say a word or two about that in her presentation. Turkish archaeologists who are now both more numerous and better funded than they ever were previously. And foreign participation in archaeology, in Turkey field archaeology, is almost exclusively based on partnership with Turkish-led academic projects. The British Institute, for historical and other reasons, has concentrated rather on other forms of archaeology, survey work, recording monuments above ground, historical philological work on Hittites, Byzantines, or whatever culture, and recently, as I emphasize again, on cultural heritage and what in this country, in the UK, is defined as public archaeology, the interaction, if you like, archaeology with the public that consumes and enjoys and profits from the subject. By and large, the BIA doesn't do a lot of work on what you might call objects, object archaeology, and has relatively few connections to UK museums. The museum world of collections and so on is not something which the Institute has, it's not excluded, but it's not an intensive relationship. For most of its history, from 1948 until recently, till now, should we say, the BIA's role has been low-key and low-profile, with one spectacular exception, which is the excavation of Çatal Huyuk near Konya. The BIA has not been involved in eye-catching excavations, which have produced spectacular sort of epoch-defining discoveries. I'm not going to say much about Çatal Huyuk. I'd be very happy to answer any questions that you may have, but I don't want this talk to be distracted into a topic which easily becomes distracting. The work at Çatal Huyuk proved a bit of a mixed blessing for the BIAA in that it produced spectacular results in the 1960s, but ended rather scandalously, as it ended the in Turkey career of James Mellart. Then there was a long intermission until the 1990s when the project was brought back to life under completely different circumstances and with very different objectives. One of the consequences for the British Institute was that between about 1967 and 1993, the Institute was definitely on the defensive. It had got embroiled in a slightly scandalous and difficult episode, which led, I think, to very, very cautious policies in an environment where it didn't quite trust itself, maybe rightly, to take more risks than it might otherwise have done. So although an enormous amount of valuable work was done in that period, and my own career was defined by it, because a great deal of the work I did in Turkey was precisely in that period, I think viewed globally, one could say that this was a period when the Institute drew in its horns rather than sort of was striking out with a very high profile. During that period, the impact of British research, archaeological research in country on the bilateral relations of Turkey and Turkey and Britain was minimal outside academic archaeology. I wrote a big book, other people wrote big books which were read by specialists, but nobody outside our field would have found their lives changed by anything that we did. However, there was, I think there's one really important exception to make to that generalization, and that is that throughout the entire period, almost all the scholars, younger, older, middle career, who spent time in Turkey working in the Institute on its projects, have made Turkey a focal point of their own academic work, and indeed to some extent their own sort of life experience, and therefore created an important reservoir of Turkey specialists or would-be specialists who introduced work on Turkey to British universities, in a way which I think, and also facilitated UK visits by Turkish scholars, in a way which I think has been unequivocally beneficial to bilateral relations. And the BIA, it should be pointed out, also regularly funds scholarships enabling Turkish or Turkey-based scholars, and also from the wider Black Sea region, to work for shorter periods in the UK. And I think the intention is that we're going to double the number of scholarships next year, because it's our 75th anniversary year. So if any of you are thinking, or you have friends and colleagues in Turkey who are looking to do a spell of research in the UK, next year is the absolute ideal opportunity for them to put in their applications. So much for a sort of little glance back at history. I want to end now with some thoughts about where we are today with the Institute. Since 2006, the Institute has been under the direction of a Belgian woman, Dr. Lutwarde van der Put, who is now very much a veteran of the region and indeed among the British institutes abroad, all of them. She is the senior director among the eight overseas institutes. And this is a period when Sir David Logan, who is of course about to speak, was chair of the Institute for more than a dozen years and introduced a completely new dimension, I think, to the Institute's activities through his own diplomatic experience and the contacts which he was able to bring to bear on our activities. During this period, traditional permits for archaeological work became much rarer. Even applications for British scholars to work in Turkish museums were regularly refused as a sort of, do we call it, reprisal for the British Museum supposedly withholding hesitating, or however you'd like to put it, on the transfer of objects from the UK back to Turkey, matters over which the BIA had and has no control. However, during this time, opportunities for other forms of partnerships in other disciplines have increased substantially. And the BIA is more active and attracts funding from a wider range of sources than ever before. So I think that the opportunities that were created by the disadvantages have been generally very well used. Among other things, relations through the British Embassy in Ankara with the Foreign and Commonwealth Office are now much closer than they ever were, not least thanks to David Logan's energetic application to those relationships, without in any way altering the basic fact that the Institute is a completely independent organization. So just to list the three projects which I think sort of define or help to define this change. One has already been mentioned. I've been mentioned in connection with the five-year program From Enemies to Allies, which tracked British-Turkish relations from 1914 to 1960 through a series of four workshops held in Turkey and Britain, Ankara, Istanbul, Oxford, and Cambridge, to be precise, all of which have now been published, and in fact, the publications which appeared in a group of journals are now being pulled together in a volume which should appear this year. That received diplomatic support, both on the Turkish and British side. It brought in contact Turkish historians, Turkish and British experts in international relations, political science, a constituency which is differs from our traditional one. The second point I want to emphasize, I've already mentioned, is the strong emphasis on cultural heritage management as being a speciality very much of a sort of British, well, it's not unique to Britain, but Britain does cultural heritage management on a on a large scale in both regionally and governmentally. And we've introduced the BIA in collaboration with Koç University, with Turkish museums and other agencies, introduced a very large program funded with over £1 million worth of funding on saving archaeological and other heritage monuments in threatened areas in Turkey. And that has now generated one, and I hope very soon, a second follow-on project, which are really going to export this Anglo-Turkish partnership, which SARAT, as it's is called, to the rest of the Middle East. It involves partners in Lebanon, it involves partners in Jordan. And so a model which has been developed in Turkey by the British-Turkish collaboration is now going to be exported. And the third and final point to mention, which is one that excites me very much, is the current initiative on which is related to contemporary climate change issues, which is about water management, which is a major problem worldwide, but quite specifically in Turkey as well. And we have two projects running in Istanbul with the metropolitan municipality there and in a rural part of Konya to improve, develop, examine water use, water management in various ways. And that is both an initiative of the British Institute at Ankara, but it's also a generalized one of all those 8 overseas research institutes, funded at least in part and initially by the Overseas Development Agency in the UK. And that, I think, is a sort of vital focus for our current work, which I'm very optimistic is going to make a fairly serious impact, not only on water management, but also on the relationship between the two countries, because it gives a platform which is a mutually beneficial for both sides. As a result, I conclude optimistically, the BIA is now more firmly engaged with modern Turkey than it ever was. It doesn't have a diplomatic role, but it's finally beginning to create a proper place, I think, for itself in the cultural relations between UK and Turkey, creating new opportunities for scholars, researchers, and participants in both countries. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. I'd also like to thank Yaprak for her generous introduction. If I could just say, my grandchildren mock me as a fellow of the Society of Antiquities. He's actually antiquities. Antiquities being the things we live like Stephen work on.
I thought it was a typo.
And I also should say, Stephen being friends of the kind of art me, but you know, as I'm sure you all know, he is a prisoner to Ankara. He has been working in association since the 1960s. He's done every conceivable job there. But more importantly, he is an archaeologist of Turkey of enormous distinction and has been responsible for a tremendous amount of the relationship which exists and continues to flourish between Turkish academics and British academics. I want to say goodbye to Ambassador Yalçın. I mean, he's leaving at the end of November, and it's great that he's here. He's been here for 4 years. It's blindingly obvious, of course, that British-Turkish relations are always important, sometimes difficult, and often volatile. But he's been here during a period of exceptionally important, it's fair to say, and has played a very important role in relationship with the CISAs, friendly, sometimes difficult, and sometimes volatile, but which really matters to all of us. Brexit was in his time, then he's had 4 years of, you know, real global tensions and volatility of all kinds. Now the Russian invasion of Ukraine, in which Turkey plays an extremely important part, he's had all of that as handled the situation with enormous skill. I'm going to tell a story which I hope you won't mind. You all may remember in President Trump's time that the British had an ambassador in what you call Kim Darrow. Kim wrote an extremely perceptive, but also frank and critical telegram about President Trump, which was leaked. I mean, probably all saw, well, many people have seen it. And President Trump did not like it at all. But, you know, it's something which we all in this room would think was absolutely right. Now, Ambassador Yeltsin has been ambassador here through, I think, probably about four varyingly dysfunctional British prime ministers. and there was a time when Judith and I were having dinner with him. It was inviting me to lunch. And we said to him, go on, tell us what your telegrams to Ankara about the British prime minister really. So he said, well, you know, of course, I tell you how it is. So we said, just tell us whether your telegrams are like Kim Darrow's. And he looked at us and he didn't say a word.
No leakage so far.
Anyway, now he's on his way together with his wife, and we'll miss him very much. We'd like to thank him very much indeed. He's going to retire, I believe. So, he also looks like he is still a hard lad. So I'm going to talk mainly about soft power. And I'd like to start with a bit of history. Back to the Helsinki Final Act of 1975, that which really is a bit some time ago now, but the cultural and media part of that agreement, which is known as Basket Three, played an important role in the downfall of the Soviet Union. Because it exposed ordinary Soviet citizens to the contrast between life in the East and life in the West. And what affected them were the societal outcomes and the benefits of political freedom compared with their own situation. We didn't talk about soft power at the time, but fast forward to the downfall of the Soviet Union, the early 90s, when communist regimes were collapsing. That was when the term came into use. And with it came, and it provided a lot of the impetus for the transformation of the former communist states into pluralist democracy. Now, however, the term is applied to individual states. And there's an entire soft power industry which employs a complex matrix of indices covering everything down to French cuisine and British football. I'm skeptical about the value of this industry. You know, choose the right indices, your country is bound to score well. But that doesn't mean that soft power is unimportant. On the contrary, governments take it seriously, particularly if, like the UK, they rank high on soft power, but are a bit short on hard power. We're in an academic environment. I want first to emphasize not just the inevitability, but also the desirability of the involvement of academia in soft power. Some might worry that power is an asset which government wields in the pursuit of policy objectives. If the government exploits the fruits of academic research for its own ends, will not academia be tarnished and its objectivity compromised? Well, the answer is no. All of us here represent institutions which are components of British soft power. The respect in which British research and academic excellence are widely held make a very important contribution to Britain's standing in the world and therefore its soft power. We cannot stop that, even in the unlikely event that we wanted to. And in any case, the government can't exploit UK soft power in a concrete fashion in pursuit of particular policy objectives. to do so would immediately destroy the asset, because its value depends precisely on its independence from government policy making. The Chinese Confucius centers are an example of what happens when government throws money at a soft power asset. It's clear that these centers are not devoted just to the promulgation of the Chinese language and Chinese culture, but also to the projection of Chinese power, of Chinese overseas interests. Their soft power value is therefore discounted, though I have to say that I think this is trust, seems to be otherwise the society. So one component of British soft power is, as I say, the very high regard in which our higher education and research capacities are held. Our ranking is affected by the level of resources devoted to these assets. And I'm afraid that one fairly recent publication says that while the UK continued to shine in soft power rankings, its score in the education sub-index had declined. The report said that this should set alarm bells ringing, as this was a critical element of British soft power. And the fact is that our academic institutions are more vulnerable to cuts on economic grounds than other big budget expenditures. In spite of their great contribution to soft power, most of them don't have powerful defenders in political life, and they offer no quick or tangible payoffs, whatever the Chinese may say. But of course, consistent and sustained funding is precisely what all our institutions like the LSE need. Now, as Stephen has been saying, the BIAA and the other bureaus made a contribution to the esteem in which British academic excellence is held. They're regionally based and thus offer tangible and direct access to British research resources and expertise to local specialists in the fields in which they operate. The BIA, for example, has offices in the main, in a main boulevard in Anchorage. Many of the staff there are Turkish. There are frequent events and lectures held there. Today, we're focusing particularly on archaeology, but the BIA has specialists in a range of other fields, including historical and contemporary political issues, all working closely with Turkish counterparts. Steams also said that bureaus have an enormous reservoir of local expertise and large networks of local contacts. They can work on issues that would be inaccessible to researchers based outside the region. From the government's point of view, they make a significant contribution to the UK's profile and standing in regions which are sometimes unstable and where important British interests are at stake. There's one lesson from the post-Cold War contribution is that hard power would solve those problems. I want to conclude with some criticisms of both governments, both the British and the British governments. As Stephen said, permits for British archaeology projects are very rare. And I believe that with goodwill on both sides, the British Museum issue, which has absolutely nothing to do with the BIA, could be resolved. And the benefit to the common good in the field of archaeology would be great. But hostility towards the West, which is a feature of Turkish government policy far too often, affects cooperation with academic institutions such as the BIA, which is wrongly regarded as an organ of an unfriendly government. As Stephen said, it's nothing to do with the British government. And it's also worth noting, this is for the British, really, in the audience, it's also worth saying that soft power indices lag considerably behind the behind the position they report to be reflected. The British in the audience can easily think of reasons why our standing is likely to decline. The government shouldn't be complacent by our current high position. In the context of the present discussion, our position will be affected by Brexit because of our loss of access to major European research funding sources. And the higher education research assets I've mentioned are inevitably diminished when we deprive ourselves of the multiplier effect of membership. And finally, the British government needs to remember why the Confucius centers are regarded as instruments of Chinese policy and not as centers of Chinese culture. British academic repute depends on the receipt of government funding, which is not tied to policy objectives, but which is provided to enable independent research and independent thinking. Thank you.
Thank you. Hello all. Thanks for your interest in our topic, and you all welcome. Thanks for the wonderful introduction to Professor Gürsoy, our significant speakers and excellency and our audience. Today, in order to give you a Turkish perspective to our topic, I will talk about a brief overview of the history of archaeology in Turkey. And then British archaeologists and foreign archaeological institutions in Turkey, and the evolution of Turkish state policies about the archaeological researches. And finally, I will reflect on how these regulations and policies acted as soft power in cultural diplomacy, and how these policies affected the works of scholars, both Turkish and foreign. But before I start, I would like to give a brief background information about archaeology, because I know that not all of us are archaeologists. Since its inception as a scientific discipline in the late 18th century, archaeology has always been intertwined with politics. It was used as an imperial show-off, as a means of imperial show-off, or it was used as a tool of nation building. But over the course of 200 years, its quarries, its concerns have changed. It's not just about beautiful monumental art and glorious artifacts. Today, monumental objects and artifacts or art of past cultures, but about those cultures, let's say, use of environment, their geography, their social religious life, or their gender issues. So we are more interested in that. So the context of the artifact has become much more important than the artifact itself. The archaeology today cooperates with many other disciplines in modern archaeology, today's archaeology, such as chemistry, botanic, sociology, computational technologies, restoration, heritage, you name it. So a true modern archaeological research, let it be an excavation or a survey, requires a cooperation of several different disciplines and also cooperation of several different scientists from several different nations. So now we can move on to the history of archaeology in Turkey. At the turn of the 18th to 19th century, Ottoman lands were one of the first to face the initial wave of Western explorers, as it still incorporated all the Near East, Egypt, Anatolia, the Aegean, and the Balkans, the prime targets of explorers in search of biblical or classical archaeological remains. The goal of most European archaeological explorations conducted in the Ottoman lands was to collect monumental art and glorious artifacts to be displayed in European museums. In 1830s, for example, Sir Charles Fellowes took on the excavation and transportation of a large sculptured monumental tombs from Lycia in southwestern coast of Turkey, Turkey to London. And the so-called Lycian marbles became one of the most treasured collections displayed in the British Museum. Late Ottoman response to this increasing interest in the archaeology of its land was not ignorant. Ottoman bureaucrats knew that not all foreign researchers had academic concerns. Some of these explorers were looking for profits in the newly established antiquity markets. Others were working for the military and political intelligence services under the cover of archaeology, and the most famous one being Thomas Lawrence, or as we know him, Lawrence of Arabia. And some others were looking down at the Ottoman modernization with their colonial outlook. Soon, in 1869, a new imperial museum opened, so-called Musée Humayun in Istanbul. And it meant to store and exhibit the archaeological finds from the Ottoman lands. And in 1884, a new Ottoman antiquities legislation, the so-called Asar-ı Atika, which banned the export of any archaeological objects from Ottoman lands, was introduced. The archaeology during the late Ottoman Empire did not have an ideological component. Unlike Greece, for example, it was not part of a nation building. But it was practiced by a handful of elites, like Osman Hamdi Bey, as a process of westernization. They tried to protect the antiquities that could attract Westerners and prevent their constant transfer to foreign countries. Well, things have changed with the establishment of a Turkish Republic. Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the founder of modern Turkey, had a personal interest in archaeology. Archaeology became part of national politics, and it was used to support the new Turkish identity thesis that saw its roots in Anatolia, in the Hittite and Sumerian cultures. And trying to grasp all ancient civilizations of Anatolia, including Greek, Roman, and Byzantine, as part of this identity. Well, this Anatolian synthesis, however, was not always welcomed by the ultra-nationalist or religiously conservative groups who prioritized Turkish or Islamic past. Despite its initial nationalistic ambitions, archaeology in early Republican Turkey was open to any scientific cooperation from foreign institutes, with the personal initiative taken by Atatürk himself. Excavations both by Turks and foreigners were encouraged, and talented young students were promoted to study archaeology in European countries. In the 1930s, German and French were given the permit to open archaeological institutes in Istanbul. And slightly later, in 1947, the British Archaeological Institute opened in Ankara. Even during the political turmoil of the years of World War II, in spite of the concern of foreign intelligence service members going around the country disguised as archaeologists, research permits were allocated to foreign scholars in almost every part of the country. Furthermore, Jewish and anti-Nazi scholars of archaeology were being invited to Turkey, and they started teaching at Turkish universities, raising Turkish young Turkish archaeologists. So it is evident that Turkish state, once sure of the scholarly concerns of the foreign applicants, were taking the risk and were prioritizing science over politics. Okay, in the 1950s and 60s, a generation of Turkish scholars who were trained with foreign professors, both in Turkey or abroad, sustained collegial friendships and thus collaborative projects. There was no negative feeling against foreigners. As the number of excavations increased, Antiquities Department in Ankara introduced many new regulations for permits. These permits were very important as they had, and they still have, a pivotal role in securing access for continued research, and the very process of obtaining them requires active cultural diplomacy. Well, reluctance of some foreign teams to comply with the changing regulations, however, soon sparked nationalistic responses, which was highlighted with the so-called Dorak affair in 1968. English archaeologist James Mellart, director of the Çatalhöyük excavations, was suspected of involvement in antiquities black market, and due to his publication of these imaginary Dorak finds. The press took this Dorak affair as a symbol of foreign archaeological missions conspiracy with the illegal antiquity market, and which evidently further triggered an anti-foreign atmosphere. The last decade before the turn of the century marks the climax of archaeological activities in Turkey. International teams working in the field through joint projects and the quality of the work steadily increasing. Also, the exchange of students and experts became bidirectional, not only as in the earlier times, Turkish students going abroad, but foreigners are also coming to Turkey to study. Early 2000s saw a sudden and unpredicted increase in the number of universities all around Turkey, and almost most of them with archaeology departments. Archaeology unexpectedly had become a popular subject, and there was a growing interest by the general public. This also led to the introduction of more new policies and more politicization of archaeology. A number of excavation permits changed hands from foreign teams to local universities. Research permits of scientific missions of particular countries were conditioned to repatriation of antiquities. A famous example, as you can see on the slide, being the repatriation of the Hittite Sphinx. In 2011, the Ministry of Culture and Tourism, Mr. Günay, declared that German excavations at the Hittite capital, Hattusha, or modern Bolasko, will be stopped unless the Sphinx taken to Berlin for restoration all the way back in 1915 is returned. Well, indeed, in May 2011, the German government announced that it would repatriate the Sphinx as a voluntary gesture of friendship between Germany and Turkey. Well, also part of this new wave, new populist policies started to put tourism in front of academic concerns. Almost every excavation, Turkish or foreign, or regardless of the type of site under research, was expected to carry heavy restoration so that they can attract tourists. According to some new regulations, foreign scientific teams of archaeology in Turkey should have a Turkish co-director, and the research team should consist of 51% Turkish citizens and 49% foreigners. A new legislation passed in 2020, just recently, to protect the ancestors' teams and their reproduction in foreign lands, even affected the study of archaeobotanists, both Turkish and foreigner. This legislation demanded the handover of all the organic remains collected in the archaeological researches to central governmental institutions. By the way, I have to say that ancient seeds preserve only in the burnt form. Thus, they are not live, so they cannot be reproduced. Well, clearly, these regulations have initial very good intentions, such as to train and employ Turkish students about the heritage of their own land and to stop the illicit trafficking of antiquities. But some of the strict rules, we have to say, that are causing the foreign researchers to lose their interest in Anatolian archaeology and pursue their academic research in other geographies. This statistical data of research permits taken from the website of the General Directorship of Cultural Assets in Museums in Ankara shows the decreasing interest of foreign research teams in Anatolian archaeology. The number of Turkish excavations in Turkey in 2006 was 71, and foreign excavations, 39. The number of Turkish surveys in 2006, 72, and foreign surveys, 32. Then we come to 2021, the number of Turkish excavations reached up to 146. Wonderful achievement. Foreign excavations remained at the number of 28. And I have to add that of this 28, only one team is from the UK institution, and that's the Boncukurlu excavations. The number of Turkish surveys, again in 2021, was 125, and foreign surveys, 9. Well, despite all the odds, there is a new generation of archaeologists emerging in Turkey, open to the world, full of enthusiasm, with high academic standards. Just recently, in 2018, a new Turkish Institute of Archaeology opened. Well, even though they came under fire by the nationalistic press for using European Union's money for an establishment of a national institute or for not being all inclusive of all the foreign and Turkish scholars, this is a good step towards the depoliticization of archaeology as an independent scientific discipline. Well, even if there have been some problems in the system, the Turkish archaeology has so strong roots that once the political concerns lessen, the system will surely run. And distinguishing between the matters related to politics and science. And I would like to end with this image. The image of this astonishing marble relief recently discovered from the excavations I lead in İzmit, ancient Nicomedia in Turkey. It symbolizes the collegiality of the embracing Roman co-emperors Diocletian and Maximian. And for us, could work as an iconic image which metaphorically encapsulates the concordance Turkish and British archaeologists need when working together. This cooperation could work for the benefit of both sides, for the benefit of science, and for the benefit of cultural heritage itself. Thank you.
Well, many thanks for your presentations. And coming from different fields with different experiences, I think it was a great, summary of both the history of the BAA and the history of archaeology in Turkey. So thank you again for your presentations. We can open the floor to questions. So if you are watching us on Zoom, you can type your question to the Q&A box, and I will try to take questions online. And if you are here with us, you can also raise your hand, and we can, with the microphone roaming around in the room, ask you to speak and address your questions to the speakers. I have questions as well to the speakers. Maybe I should start my questions first. So I have two questions to both Sir Logan and Professor Mitchell. So you can answer the question, whichever question you like, and I will leave it up to you. So I think both of you can answer both of the questions. So my first question is, as I was listening to the history of the AIIA, I thought, why archaeology? So when the British Institutes started to work and operate in these foreign territories, why did they choose archaeology? Why did they prioritize archaeology? So if you can give us a bit of a context with that regard, that would be brilliant. With regards to soft power, my research on soft power and especially Turkish perceptions of the UK actually show a paradox or a dilemma where the UK is seen as a model with its democracy, with its parliamentary system, and it is looked up as, you know, something that Turkey and its westernization ideals could imitate, perhaps. So that's British soft power. But at the same time, we see, because of historic reasons, and you know, the examples that Professor Share has also given, because of the imperialistic agenda of the UK in the 19th century, perhaps, there's the perception that British power is actually dangerous for Turkish interests. So my question is, how much can institutions like the British Institute or academic work, cooperation, because ultimately this is what we are talking about, right? How academics working in a field like archaeology can collaborate and you know, help both countries understand each other better. But do you believe that that is possible? Is it possible to reverse these historical, you know, experiences and renew relations and perhaps forget about the past? What would it take? Is that possible? And to Professor Share, I would like to ask, I mean, you started your talk with the political influence, with political influence on archaeology. And that's, I think, in your presentation from the very beginning up until now was evident, even though the political influence seems to have changed. So my question is, what about other countries and what about other experiences? So isn't it the case at the moment in many other countries that we know of, or perhaps we are not really familiar with, that you know, you need to get government approval in order to excavate? If you're a foreigner, you wouldn't be able to go to a land and start excavating, right? So is what you know, are these policies and regulations really unique to Turkey, or you know, do they also exist elsewhere? And if we have questions in the audience, His Excellency, please.
Should we read the answers for you?
Maybe we can collect questions, because I'm mindful of the time as well. We have 20 minutes, so we can take your question, answer, and then we'll, yeah.
First of all, I would like to thank Contemporary Turkish Studies and European Institute of LSE and Yaprak for you to choose this topic in the middle of all chaotic situations in the world, and when the hard power is number one issue for many countries or for many regions. You reminded us the importance of soft power. Thank you so much. And also thank you for Tuna's, David and Steven's enlightening presentation for us. Secondly, also David, thank you very much for your nice words to me and for my 4-year tenure in London. Secondly, I would like to share with one of my anecdotes for 4-year tenure. When I came to London in 2018 October, the first invitation I received was an event about archaeology in Turkey at SOAS, and I started with that event. Now, today's event is not my last. It's not my last event, but one of the last events, and I started archaeology 4 years ago in London, and I am ending my tenure in archaeology. I think it's a beautiful coincidence. And thirdly, I would like to share very recent good news with you that we recently signed a memorandum of understanding of a cooperation with British Museum, and from now on we can start amazing cooperations in different exhibitions and studies with British Museum. And secondly, we also signed another protocol of cooperation with the Victoria Albert Museum. It allows us to be able to exhibit some Turkish items who have been brought from Turkey to museum years ago. I think these recent protocols with British Museum and Victoria Albert will be wonderful opportunities for develop our cultural relationship further. And lastly, I have a question to you, Stephen. My question, when I was preparing my question, now I heard your question, Yaprak. I think this question is the other side of Yaprak's question. I really wonder, because I know how your institute achievements in Turkey. I mean, we are grateful for more than 70 years tremendous efforts in different areas of culture, education, archaeology in Turkey. I'm wondering how all these efforts, achievements in Turkey had reflections in the perception of British intelligence, academia, media, or people. Because you are wondering the perception of Turkey, but also I'm wondering all these more than 70-year efforts or achievements, have they reflected here in some way? I really would like to hear from you. Thank you.
Yeah, we can, I think, answer now, and then we'll do another round of questions.
I think it falls to me to try and answer the last question first, which is the hardest one. I think that the work of the British Institute in Ankara, I emphasize that it's a very small organization and that therefore the wider impact, the direct impact on British understanding of Turkey, necessarily quite small. I mean, you know, I wrote my career-defining book, which was about Anatolia, which sold about 1,000 copies over 30 years. So you can see that it's not exactly a bestseller. However, it always gets cited.
It is for us. You're a legend.
well, probably costs too much. But in my field, I mean, in archaeology and ancient history, when I started in 1968 or 70, when I was a postgraduate student, there was hardly anybody in the UK in my field that studied ancient Turkey, ancient Turkey before the Turks, shall we say, in a serious, consistent way. There was a tiny handful of literature. Now it's an enormous industry. And so that through academic connections anyway, university courses, books written, research areas opened up, the ancient world, which is my business, looks totally different because people have engaged seriously with Turkey and everything it has, across art, across documents, across history of religion, and so on and so forth. And no serious student or scholar who wants to understand something about that world can now make a, they can't bypass Turkey. It's front and center. So I think that's the first part of my answer. The second part, has this impacted on a wider public? Yes, surely, but indirectly. I mean, as you know, tourism in Turkey is, I don't know whether it's the number one, number two, or number three tourist destination for British tourists. I live now in Germany.
Nine, 10.
Oh, 9 and 10. Oh, well, we've got a way to go, but we'll get there. I live in Germany now, where it's, you know, a major. And not all of them, of course, engage with the sort of things that fascinate us, but a significant number do. Again, going autobiographical, 1965, I was about 17 years old and I took a train to Greece. And there was a young woman on the train and she had gone to Istanbul. And I didn't dare go that far because that was a sort of barrier that you could cross. Mm-hmm. I mean, not, of course you could, but that was a step. But 1966, though, I went. And of course, since then, that barrier has disappeared. So I think that I'm not saying the British Institute is responsible for this change, but the bilateral relations in the broadest sense are responsible for that change. And now, so it's sort of taken for granted, the relationship is now not a, it's problematic in all sorts of ways, but it's not really challenging. It's we engage, and that actually is my answer to the first question from Yaprak, which was, no, we can't set the historical, I don't want the historical clock to start at zero now. Now, I'm a historian, everything has a past. If you look at British literature about Turkey or the Ottoman Empire up until 1970, it's laced with misunderstanding and prejudice. The 19th century travelers in Turkey, the things they say about the country hardly bear reading now. I mean, they're very hard to read as an expression of misunderstanding of what the Ottoman Empire stood for. As a result, Ottoman studies were nowhere in Britain until very, very recently. And they've now been reinvented as actually recent Ottoman studies, sort of the late Ottoman period is very much in focus, not the grand golden age. And therefore, why the British Institute was founded, you know, why at all? Well, it was a sort of engagement with the Middle East, archaeological interest in the Middle East. The Hittites were the trigger for the British Institute. We still do Hittite studies, but that's no longer the main, or even by a long way, not the most important focus. That was the starting point. And I don't think you could have predicted in 1948 the way that British understanding of ancient Turkey would develop over the next 50 years, because it in fact has developed in all sorts of other ways. So it was serendipitous. It was just a professor in Liverpool who decided that we should have an institute in Ankara. And you know, the seed was sown, and it luckily it landed on fertile ground. And somehow, by a complicated process, we've got to where we are now.
Could I say something about the your question, yeah, about, you know, the, you know, the view of the Brits as imperialists and how that affects all that? I mean, the UK, it always in the first two or three in salt pine disease. And the same is true of other quote imperialist countries like the United States, France, Germany, they're always there. So in the soft power context, this issue of imperialism is not an issue. But of course, and this applies, if you like, even more to the United States, if you run a poll among Turks of what they think about the United Kingdom, we are not very high up there. You know, we're sure to be a pretty dodgy lot of, you know, I don't know, perpetual Albion, if you like, French says, you know, we're regarded with suspicion by the Turkish public at large, and I guess the Americans even more so. So, and that's not necessarily it's connected with the imperialism point, but it also has to do with contemporary visions of what our countries get up to. So that's, I mean, I don't for a moment want to say that these soft power and popular attitudes to the UK are in completely separate boxes. They're certainly linked. But I think my answer to your question would be that I don't think, like, you know, that our soft power, you know, profile, if you like, which is internationally very high, in Turkey is mediated by this perception of the UK as a pretty dodgy bunch of people.
Politics. Yeah, okay. Archaeology and politics, as I said, We even have a subfield called archaeopolitics. I'm not an expert on it. We have great scholars like Mehmet, Professor Mehmet Özdoğan, Zeynep Çelik. If you want to read further on archaeopolitics, you can look at their wonderful publication. In regards to the political intervention for the archaeological research permits, I can say that as a rule, most countries, they require an official, a governmental permit for their archaeological from foreigners in order to comply to the centralized oversight of the management of archaeological sites and artifacts. Indeed, it's not just Turkey. As far as I know, in Greece, for example, each nation can get 3 archaeological excavation permits and 3 archaeological surveys, but not including the collaborative projects. So they have limits. Again, in order to assure the transnational participation, or in order to avoid all these colonial approaches, in other countries like Mexico, Peru, I think Guatemala, the governments require foreign applicants to have a co-PI or co-director for their archaeological projects. So it's not just unique to Turkey. So many countries have these policies, and they are becoming stricter with this decolonization, decolonize the museum movement. It's becoming stricter and stricter.
Okay. Yeah, can I say something? I wanted to say how warmly I welcome what the ambassador had to say about this agreement with the British Museum. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's fantastic. Because talking about Turkish soft power, there have been no Turkish exhibitions, anything like that, in the UK for so long. And I mean, all of us who are there remember vividly the wonderful Turkish exhibition, I think it was called The Turks, wasn't it, at the Royal Academy? I mean, which was fantastic. And you know, everyone was a enormous number of visitors and people saw it. So, I mean, that was Turkish soft power. So I'm delighted that that's what it was.
So we can take questions from the audience. 2 questions if we have from the room, and then I have several questions from the online audience as well. Yes, please.
Good evening. A rather sensitive question which might put you on the spot. Is the experience of the panel about hardening attitudes throughout the world to archaeologists from former colonial powers a result of ultra-nationalists gaining power in a lot of countries, or populist governments appealing to local populations? Or is it the perception of the colonized countries that places like the British Museum are full of stolen artifacts from colonial times? Or are there other factors at play in making the job of academics and archaeologists difficult?
Thank you. Any other questions? Mina?
Actually, it follows on from okay. The awkward question. Mine isn't quite as awkward, but I was wondering.
You also introduced yourself. I'm really sorry that we forgot. If you can also introduce yourself.
I live in Sydney, Australia. My name is Darshak Mehta. Okay. I'm originally from Bombay, but I've lived in Sydney for 35 years. I'm about to go to Turkey in 2 days' time.
Thank you.
I'm Nina Toksos. I'm a BIA council member. The you mentioned the Anatolian synthesis, which the Republic decided to adopt all the civilizations that came before. And it relates to the previous question in the sense that how much is this adhered to, or how much has this been diluted, or is official policy still recognizing this? Seems, like a very humanistic approach to me.
Okay, so now I have 8 questions, online questions. I will ask the online audience to vote their question, vote the questions that they like, because if they like the questions, it will move up and it will make my job easier. I will go ahead and ask 3 questions that were asked first. One of them is actually quite quick. I mean, you will be able to answer it rather quickly. Does the BAA do any work in Cyprus and Kakatece, where there is a Turkish government? Celia, this question was from Keith Rovan. Celia Carlake from Oxford University, retired and chair of BATAS, is asking, what particular artifacts is the Turkish government most anxious to have repatriated by the UK, and why? If you have any knowledge on the matter, that would be appreciated. And then Owen Drunen is asking a question about Turkey's soft power. So not British soft power necessarily, but Turkish soft power. What can Turkey do to increase its own soft power?
Well, the easy question is no, we don't have any activities current or in my memory in Cyprus, either north or the west of Cyprus. So. Simply no. We do work a little bit in the Black Sea region, and we would be quite keen to work more in the Black Sea region as far as our capacity is there, but the focus is on mainland, as it were, Turkey almost exclusively at the moment. The artifacts, I may be able to give a better answer than I have, but I know that the focal point of 15 years ago was a particular stele from Samosata, from Adiaman, which complicated story, as you would expect, which had been removed from Turkish territory to possibly Syrian territory sometime before the First World War. So there was a sort of a very complicated background, and that was the object
that's the only one that I know.
It's ironic because it's a particularly boring scene. So who wants it? And there are, as far as the Brits are concerned, there's an inconceivable document. I mean, there's an export license stamped by the Turkish, by the Ottoman authorities, and centrifuges of ex government. So it's ironic that that should be the issue.
The Anatolian synthesis. It had very early in the beginning, during Mustafa Kemal's time, it had different ambitions. Like they tried to prove that Hittites were Turks, maybe, but it's evident that they're not Turkish. But they tried to grasp all the cultures that lived in Anatolia for thousands of years. And indeed, it's still relevant. There is a group of Turkish scholars. They are very supportive of this Anatolian synthesis to the point that they think that everything is born from Anatolia. All the Greek classical culture is the root of the classical culture is in Anatolia. But the number of the excavations explain it well. Now, Turkish archaeology is not just about excavating Ottoman or Islamic sites, but lots of Roman, Greek sites. 146, some of these are Bronze Age, even earlier. And there's this recent emphasis on Göbekli Tepe, for example. It has nothing to do with Islam or being Turkish. And so it's on the spotlight right now. So I think it's still relevant, that this Anatolian synthesis. And for your question, I don't think that it has this hardening of rules, hardening of rules, it does not have anything to do with ultra-nationalists imposing things. I think it's related to this decolonize the museum or decolonization. Well, I have to say, everything that is taken from a country's land unlawfully, illegally, it should be returned back. But this doesn't mean that, archaeology has a 200 years of narrative. So if we judge the past with our current perceptions, it will just create more hatred towards colonial approaches. So those explorers in the 18th century, late 18th century, they took artifacts from different lands and they carried, transferred them to faraway lands to exhibit in their museums. But they also contributed to the evolution the inception of archaeology as a discipline because they sparked interest in those countries. They helped because other people in the UK, they didn't know about, let's say, or when Napoleon invaded Egypt, the whole Egyptology, the discipline of Egyptology created after that because they stimulated this interest. This doesn't mean that everyone can, you know, take objects, artifacts from different lands and carry them around. It should be done in the legal framework, I believe. And I also believe in the existence of global museums, because as a lecturer myself, I really enjoy, let's say, talking about Lydian Sardis at the Metropolitan Museum to a wide range of students and teaching them Anatolian archaeology in front of an artifact from Lydia. In Istanbul Archaeology Museum, it just reopened after 10 years of restoration. If you haven't visited, so it's amazing, the new galleries. Yeah, we have all these objects from, let's say, we are proud of Alexander sarcophagus, which is from Sidon, from Lebanon, and Osman Hamdi Bey excavated. And back then it was the part of Lebanon, Sidon was part of the Ottoman Empire, but it is not now. So I think it's a object artifact specific issue. I don't believe that every single thing in a museum should be returned. It should be done in the legal framework. That's what I can say, yeah.
I have a very interesting question online that I would like to pose. This is from Dr. Barışyan Arpamukkale University Department of Archaeology. So he's asking, especially to Professor Mitchell, but then the others can also respond as well, how the British Institute supports Turkish archaeologists by scholarships, fellowships, or collaborations, especially after decreasing the number of foreign researchers in Turkey. So in what sense is Turkish archaeologists being helped? And I would like to add this question as well, because I think it's related. How come there aren't a lot of Turkish archaeologists in UK universities? How about supporting Turkish archaeologists in the UK and not only in Turkey? So if you have any ideas about this question, I would appreciate it. Are there any questions from the audience here? Yes. There's someone
in
the back. Please also introduce yourself.
My name is Philip Eames. I'm an asset manager. Does Turkey have a role in facilitating the conversation or perhaps the return of artifacts that were taken from parts of the empire?
It's a related question to what you were saying. Any other questions? Would you like to start?
Which one
you want?
As far as I know, in UK, in terms of, I'm thinking of archaeology departments, I've been here for the past two or three years. I don't know of any Turkish archaeologist with a permanent position. I might be making with a permanent position in Yağmur. But again, not permanent position in an archaeology department in any of the BCom. Like there are several fellows. We work on archaeology. We come as a fellow, as a postdoc, or as a student. But I don't know of any Turkish professor teaching intensively Anatolian archaeology in UK.
Is that something that the BAA can help with?
we would give all the help we could. As I said, the BAA itself is a small organization. It does have modest funds to enable Turkish scholars to come for limited periods to the UK, but it doesn't support fellowships, long-term fellowships, still less permanent positions in UK universities. But as I say, it's not a university. That's really a question for universities to answer as to whether they can create. Of course, Turkish government funding and other supporters have created a number of posts in different disciplines, but not specifically in archaeology. And the point that David Logan mentioned about Britain severing its ties with the European Union has definitely weakened our hand in this respect, because there used to be much better access to large-scale European grants, which brought in Turkish scholars as a matter of course, not just in archaeology, of course, which are now, those still exist, but they don't direct people to British universities, they direct them to European universities in increasing numbers. So in that respect, the prospects are less good than they were. On the other hand, the generation, I mean, the fact is that Turkish universities produce large numbers of extremely well-qualified, capable, potential scholars. So the pool of Turkish aspirants to at least postdoctoral positions and beyond in the UK, as in other European countries, is now immeasurably larger than it was before, and people come in. I myself had four Turkish PhD students over my career. I'm delighted to say that the second one has just been made a rector at a Turkish university, my first rector. Yes. But actually, when I look at the current, I'm not working in Turkey actively as I was 15 or 20 years ago, so I'm not sort of a recruiting agent anymore. I think actually the simple answer to that question is, if there were more large scale British projects in archaeology running in Turkey, as you said, we have one excavation which has 49% or 51%, is it, Turkish participation in that excavation. So all those students and postdocs or whatever who are working on that excavation are then highly qualified people to come in if they seek a place in a British university. So there is an opportunity there. As the number of field projects reduces, of course, those opportunities narrow. So that's an argument for expanding the base, and then that will bring in potentially more. But alas, the British Institute is not likely in the foreseeable future to have the sort of funds that would be able actually to pay for those posts. You'd have to look to the universities and their ability to fund the positions that they need.
Sorry, Logan, would you like to add anything to the discussion?
No,
thank you. Okay.
The answer to that gentleman?
Yes, there was a question there about the possibility of returning artifacts to previous Ottoman lands.
Okay. Well, I don't know if there is, well, there are local initiations. Again, this is a very legal issue. I know of several groups, for example, Return the Lycian Marbles Group, Return the Pergamon Altar Group, but I don't know what stage they are, if they are pursuing a lawsuit or something, but I'm aware of some groups asking for the return of the objects in UK, in Germany, but I really don't know the details of the legal process right now.
But he's asking about Turkey's, what is Turkey's policy?
Turkey's policy.
That's what he's asking
about. I'm sorry, I understood the vice versa. Turkey's policy for?
Returning of the artifacts from the Ottoman days.
Okay.
Just as a colonial power, Britain and France and everyone.
Well, the thing is, it's, I think Turkey, there is this, I mentioned there is 1884, there is a regulation first introduced, Asar Açıka. That's the earliest one, and they followed the rules of the regulations for that one. But there was no interest for, let's say, no one called the return of Alexander sarcophagus, and Osman Hamdi Bey himself, the Ottoman archaeologist, who he excavated it and he founded it, and then he took it to the museum. So I'm not aware of.
I don't think we're aware of the policy. I mean, it's just it's the knowledge matter as well. But perhaps His Excellency has
you explained very correctly. I mean, there is no categoric policy of returning or not returning. A case by case study, and then as far as I know, for 35 years of my career, nobody approached us. To ask for something from Ottoman time, maybe our neighborhood don't think that Ottoman passed as a foreigner. I don't know.
So I think we will have to end our discussions here. For the audience on Zoom, I can see your questions, but we kind of ran out of time. There were some very interesting questions about the BAAA and its activities. And so you can go and visit the BAAA website and gather more information about the Institute. Perhaps you can also email them some of your questions. And if you have enjoyed our panel today, please also visit the European Institute website and the Contemporary Turkish Studies website. Many thanks once again to our distinguished speakers. It was a pleasure to listen to you. And now if you're in the audience, please join us in the reception for further discussions.